Are you interested in improving your procurement and negotiation skills and understanding? Well, this is the podcast for you. The Procurement Podcast with Andy and Christoph.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Procurement Podcast, and absolutely delighted to have my erstwhile colleague, Christoph Barry-Alvajou. I'm Andy Franks, and I work for Bright Sky Clear Mind, a procurement consultancy. And Christoph, you can introduce yourself.
Christoph Barry-Alvajou, managing BBW Global Procurement Consultancy. But this podcast is about procurement, so we are interviewing today Sarah Collins, who will introduce herself shortly. We're quite delighted. It's a very, very important topic that we're going to talk about. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Sarah, perhaps it'd be quite good to set the scene if you could give a little bit of background about who you've worked for in the past, and more importantly, you know, what you're doing now, and particularly your passion around procurement.
Yeah, well, I'm currently the head of procurement at the ABC, so that's the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. I've had a few people think I work for a company called ABC Consulting. I'm like, no, I work for the ABC.
The ABC, there is only one.
There is only one. So I've been here a bit over 5 months, so relatively new. But my background is I've been in procurement for over 20 years. So I studied manufacturing management and initially out of university was working in logistics and supply chain for Unilever, so FMCG, doing production scheduling. That was very character building.
Yes, yeah, I'm sure.
You know, age 21, 22, going down every day to after the night runs on the production lines are getting yelled at by the line managers because the production lines had stopped because
they will forge your
one of our packing materials wasn't in, but it was really interesting. To this day, I still have a love for all of my products I used to plan for 20 years ago.
Absolutely,
When I was at Unilever. But when I was doing that, so I was part of supply chain and I did used to work, this is in the late 90s, I did used to work closely with the guys in what we referred to as buying. Yeah. So one of them was creating a new role, thought I sort of had potential for it and tapped me on the shoulder to come over and work with them. And right when I was going over was when Unilever was transforming at a global level to procurement.
Yeah.
So we rebranded from sort of being site-based buying functions to national procurement. So I came into it right when manufacturing was really taking a lead on how they did a lot more aggregation and leveraging, followed a lot of things at a global level, Asia-Pac level, national level. So it was really exciting to come in at that stage. I was doing initially work in ingredients and packaging, but then I had an opportunity. Unilever started looking more at the indirects. They'd never, because they'd always had their buying done at a site level, they never looked at the indirects before. So it was a huge, big, I don't really like the expression low-hanging fruit, but it was really a big opportunity for the first time to do national deals in a lot of areas.
Just on that, in terms of what was, around that procurement, first tactic in terms of the low-hanging fruit. Which particular category did you attack first?
So we attacked it in waves, and I have to admit, someone else did actually start the initial planning and I took it over, so I have to actually claim that I didn't create the waves.
Yeah.
But we created it in waves, and we did the proof of concepts in the easy areas that a lot of organisations do, the office supplies, travel, things like that.
I was hoping you were going to say office supplies, because most people start there, because it's a very neat way of actually getting the business used to process change.
Absolutely. So, and then we started in the subsequent waves getting into more complex things around a lot of the equipment, things like that, especially a lot of factory spend where initially it was sort of off limits, but then we saw opportunities to start having deals for a lot of the MRO, et cetera, at a national level. So I was really enjoying that. I'd been coming up to being at Unilever for 8 years, and always in supply chain. And I firmly believe, by the way, that procurement is a discipline of supply chain, not finance. I'm not a finance person. I can hold my own, but I'm not a finance person.
Yeah.
And they were just naturally wanting to move me into another supply chain role. And I thought, well, I want to explore this procurement thing. I'd started meeting other procurement people, because that was back in the day when you went to supplier functions. I started meeting other procurement people and realized it was something that was quite transferable. So I initially considered going to another FMCG. I did interview for a couple of big name companies. But I also thought I'd try and test myself and go out on a limb. So I went and worked for JP Morgan.
Of course.
As you do.
Yeah, as one does.
A few people were very shocked I went from FMCG to financial services. But I was doing it because I wanted to find out if this thing I liked called procurement was actually something that I could have a career in.
Yeah.
And was it something that was transferable? And absolutely. And because I had been at that stage, I was managing the indirects at Unilever. A lot of the categories were exactly the same. I even had some of the same account managers. So it's very similar.
Just to recap, so that, how many years ago was that? That you?
That was in 2005.
Okay, 2005. So by then, I mean, I suppose, you know, from a global perspective around procurement and where it started to gravitate up the agenda at board meetings, that would be around the similar time, wouldn't it?
It was. In financial services, procurement was still quite immature. Yeah. It was nowhere near as mature as what I'd experienced in manufacturing. But JP Morgan, it was still quite inspiring because we had a CPO at the global level who sat on the board, and not many organisations have that.
Yeah.
So that was still something they took procurement seriously.
Absolutely.
I was lucky I'd come in on the end when they'd just done a massive Ariba implementation, so they'd recognised the need for systems, etc. And we're talking 14 years ago. Well, a lot of organisations still aren't at that stage now.
No.
So I was in financial services. I was there for 3 years, and the opportunity came up with the University of Sydney. I actually turned them down the first time, but they sort of hounded me and came back. And I really liked the idea of going into that space because I liked the idea that we, through procurement, could help the people in the more research and teaching side, whether it be being able to afford to be able to run more classes or to be able to afford more research equipment, etc. I liked that idea of getting in there and helping them and having purpose, because to that point I only worked for organisations where there was a bottom line.
Yeah.
And it was nice having, I mean, the university is not a not-for-profit, but it was still an angle of that more social side of it.
Contributing to that knowledge, the knowledge of body of knowledge through procurement by helping.
Exactly.
And just in terms of, I mean, I'm intrigued about the point you say, you're very clear that saying it's a procurement's a supply chain function as opposed to a finance function. And the, in terms of where those reporting lines were at the university, was that into a finance function?
It changed while I was there. Initially, we reported into the COO on par with finance. But then there was a restructure while I was there, and they took the COO level out and we reported into the CFO. So I had both. I had a reporting parallel, so the CPO and the CFO were peers, but it did actually change.
Yeah.
So I sort of experienced both different reporting directions.
Yeah.
So I was there for 5 years. We got to do a lot of strategic work transforming procurement. There had been procurement there for a few years when we started, and they'd done a lot of really great work with regards to getting out there and getting a presence with the academics, and they'd had some really great projects they'd worked on. Whilst I was there, we then started looking at taking some of it to the next level around introducing category management, some of the more strategic things around your end-to-end procurement systems. When I was there, we certainly had a lot of areas that I was quite, I guess, pleased that we were able to do, as well as working with a lot of the academics and helping them. We did a lot of work, my team, in what's now known as the Charles Perkins Centre, which is, its working name when I was there was the Centre for Diabetes and Cardiovascular Disease, I think it was. So it was a really inspiring way that they were looking across a whole stack of faculties to try and tackle these issues. And it was a very different way of them doing this research centre. So that was something really interesting that we got to work on in all sorts of different levels, whether it was the procurement for the actual building of it. We worked on the procurement for the funding, like we ran tenders to actually borrow money. We worked on the procurement for a lot of the equipment that was going into the labs, etc. So it was quite an interesting one to really see that one come from the ground up, just as an example of the sort of thing that we...
And you can sort of, I see that's where you can sort of see the real broad potential and broad value of procurement, as opposed to be just being that pure... bottom line driven, this is what it's all is. Procurement is the cost saving department, or it's the sales prevention office, or whichever way certain more structured organisations look at it.
Yeah.
And now you're passionate about sustainable procurement.
Yeah.
Well, how did you get into...
How did I get into that? Well, it sort of coincided with when I decided to leave the University of Sydney. I went to Roads and Maritime Services as part of Transport for New South Wales. And I was the chief procurement officer there, and we were going through procurement transformation because the New South Wales government required agencies to become accredited to be allowed to do procurement in their own right.
Yeah.
So I came in and I took Roads and Maritime Services through the accreditation process. I also was fortunate enough to come in just before the start of a massive big ERP program across the entire transport cluster. So I was the procurement lead for Roads and Maritime Services for that. So it was a big SAP Ariba implementation as well.
Wow.
So during that time, we're going through major transformation, but I was also working for an organisation that had a big regional footprint. So a lot of the procurement where we worked with the business was out in regional locations where we had a lot of small businesses, et cetera, that we were using. At the same time, I was approached by CIPS, so the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply. I've been a member of them since about 2007, and I've been on the New South Wales Committee since 2008. And I was approached by their acting managing director at the time in about, well, it was about 4 or 5 years ago. They needed to put a representative on the committee, the Australian committee, that was contributing to the ISO 2400 Sustainable Procurement Standard. They'd been asked as a professional body. There was a range of other bodies also having representatives on the committee, but they wanted a practitioner.
Yeah.
So this was probably about 2014, I think it was, and they asked me if I'd go on from that. So that was sort of where I really... I'd had that passion of procurement with purpose that I'd gotten from the university and at Roads and Maritime Services.
Right, yeah, being applied to that, that sustainable procurement.
So that was really interesting watching how a standard got developed, and I won't bore everybody with that. Very long.
I think that's a completely whole new podcast series.
Very long process. But we then went, once it got published in March 2017, we then went through a process of how we were starting to promote it, et cetera. And I'm still on that committee. We still have, because there's still work to be done. We're still doing promotion, et cetera. And modern slavery, that committee got involved in the modern slavery consultations, and we're still doing work in that space as well.
Okay.
So that's where I started really getting that passion for the whole social and sustainable procurement piece.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's interesting, that sustainable procurement. That's a massive, massive undertaking to, you know, for any organization to not only to understand what to do, but to follow. There's the what to do and there's the how to do it. And once you start peeling that onion, there's a lot of layers, you know, how far do you go? You know, it's a pretty big topic. And do you find organizations in Australia through the various committee that you're on at the level where they are trying to understand what it is, or they fully understand what it is and they are now trying to implement it?
I think there's varying degrees. There's some that have really taken this on. And it does tend to be organizations that are driven by a global companies where the parent companies have already started doing a lot of this work. There'd been a sustainable procurement standard in the UK prior to the ISO one. But that said, there's still a lot of Australian companies are doing some great work in this space as well, where they've had the right sort of leadership and passion behind it. And I think having the ISO standard has now given people who were supportive of this idea but maybe didn't have anything to sort of be able to take to their executive and say, I want to do this. It's given them something now. One of the things we developed as part of our the Australian committee, which was part of Standards Australia, we developed a handbook to help people implement if they are trying to deliver a business case. That's available free. If you just go onto the ISO.org website, you can find it under there, under the resources. Anyone can just take it and do what they like with it to start building their business case.
Yeah.
Because we realised that people had this standard. If you've ever read a standard, it's very long and boring.
Very dry.
And they wanted to work out how to actually do the business case. And one of the things with ISO 2400 is it's a guidance standard.
Yeah.
So you can just pick the sections that are important to your organisation at the moment. You don't have to put the whole thing
in
place.
You don't have to do the whole thing, yeah.
You don't have to get certified. And just coming back to modern slavery, it's got a section in there around the whole, you know, forced labour side of things. And that's a perfect thing that if you're required to implement the Modern Slavery Act, which, as we know, a lot of organisations in Australia are, and you've also got an interest in sustainable procurement, you could start using that section of the ISO standard as a guidance around it,
right,
if that was something, and that could help you start getting that foot in the door to say, we want to implement a sustainable procurement strategy. But I think with sustainable procurement, one of the things that there's a little bit of a misconception is people still think it's around the environmental side.
Yeah.
And that absolutely is a big part of it. But it's also about the sustainability of your actions. And that's something that really I was very aware of when I was at Roads and Maritime Services in New South Wales. So those people who aren't New South Wales based, it's our New South Wales agency for a road agency, basically. Vic Roads is the equivalent down in Victoria. Mm-hmm. And because we had so many of these suppliers in the regional locations, you know, in some cases we may have been their biggest customer. So what happens if we no longer had operations there, or we outsourced, or we ran a tender and someone else, you know, a national player won it?
Yeah.
That's that supplier
yeah.
might have to lay their staff off. They may not have business anymore. So it's trying to sort of explain to people that sustainability is also about having a legacy of what you do. So those suppliers, could we recognise that maybe they're at risk? Could we help them diversify? Also, you've got the social side of it too. You know, you're spending money. How can you spend it with areas where you're trying to stimulate the economy?
So it's a really, you know, it's a, there's a very big education piece in that, as you know, and it's almost a full spin through 180 degrees against what some people perceive procurement to be. It's like driving cost savings down, you know, let's get to the bottom line. This is all about, you know, the year end, we've got to show X amount of improvement against, you know, every part of the bottom line.
And you'll notice I haven't once said cost savings.
No, here, yeah, and I think
because procurement is about value in so many different areas,
yeah.
And we struggle on the cost saving side because a lot of the savings we have can't be seen on the bottom line.
Yeah.
So you're constantly in debate with your finance department about whether the savings are real or not.
Yeah, it's that tangible savings.
It's almost to conflict. This is the right thing to do with sustainable procurement, no doubt about it. It has to be done to contribute to the ecosystem of a local community or even a country. But then there is the survival of the organization that desperately need procurement to be as efficient as possible. And two, when you're trying to build a business case within the organization, you know, where is the budget, you know, coming from, and what support do you get from the senior management?
Yeah, and I think it's that, you know, I think the fascinating thing for me is you know, what's tangible and but what's real. You know, the tangibly is, okay, we used to spend this, we now spend this. But then if you say, actually, through our work, what we've enabled our suppliers to be able to do is to divest some of their, you know. Now, the question I most probably got there is, if you're helping educate them, but they've also got suppliers as well, how far back down that supply chain do you go? Which brings it to the supply chain piece. How far can you go?
And that's sort of the can of worms that the Modern Slavery Act is also opening up, trying to explain to people what a supply chain is. And you've got to be practical on how far back you can go.
Yeah.
And you've also got to do elements of, you know, if you're doing proper supplier segmentation, supplier management, you will understand which of your suppliers are doing this really well as well. So you might not go beyond them. And the Modern Slavery Act is an example of that. You might see that one of your tier one suppliers is doing really great stuff to address slavery in their supply chains. So you might not take that relationship any further.
Right.
But you might identify other areas as being high risk or high opportunity, and you might go further down those supply chains.
Mm.
I've certainly done that in past roles where we were having direct relationships with the actual suppliers to our suppliers, because there was value in how we developed that, or it might have been a tripartite agreement, etc. So there's a lot of history of people doing things like that because there's benefit in having that level of relationship. But it's a really good question. And when you start talking to people about supply chains, they can often get a little bit overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, start to glaze a bit.
But it's also how far you can take it, because the Modern Slavery Act is an example of that. You may have certain consumer products. I've got one of them sitting on my desk, on my table in front of me, which I use. I won't name the product, but I use it to take phone calls and check my emails. You can work out what it is. if that was found to have slavery in it, I could guarantee every single supplier in our supply chain then is exposed.
Yeah.
So you've got to be practical, and you've got to look at it from a risk perspective as well, in terms of where you focus on some of this and how far back you take it. Yeah. And also what level of trust you place in your tier one suppliers that they are doing the right thing as well.
And is it,
sorry, so at the moment, is you focusing this on the tier one, or are you going down to tier two and tier three?
This is something that across the board organisations are working out what they're wanting to do, whether it be around their supplier relationship management programs, whether it be around how they start implementing sustainable procurement, Modern Slavery Act. I mean, there's various things driving this, but I think it's really case by case what you do. You might you might decide you're going to go down a certain number of levels if it's high risk, but you might decide that in other areas you're not going to.
It's true. We did a project back in the US in the mid-90s for Bosch, where they were supplying one of the ABS brake systems for a manufacturer. And they wanted to get full visibility of their supply chain down to level 2 and level 3 of the supply chain. And as we mapped the entire bill of material and where the suppliers came from, the bill of material was nearly as long as this long, very long table here, and you know, fairly deep. And the challenge was tier 2 and tier 3 had no idea that they were doing actually business with Bosch. And it was nothing to do with sustainable procurement. It was about identifying cost driver that we could modify or change the specification of particular parts to save savings down the track. But that level of visibility, you know, that device on your table, the chances of getting a view of that supply chain is pretty much remote. You know, it's pretty much inexistent. People are not going to be...
But that's an example of that's a very well-known brand that has had exposure in the past. So they are doing an awful lot in this space. That's an example of where you would actually see what they are doing and you would make the decision, are you going to take what, you know, take their reports and what they're telling you at face value? You might have an element of wanting to do a bit more verification, but it's probably an example of where you realise they can't afford to do nothing, so they probably are doing the right thing.
Then comes to the point where you have, you know, a communication device is to dial a number and call someone else. As simplest, you know, like a car and go from A to B. And you know, maybe through the press or through media exposure, that that manufacturer has some issues with sustainable procurement. Do you have the power to say, no, we're going to go to the competitor because they are, you know, better at this, you know, type of work? Do you have the support of the organization saying, oh, actually, you know?
Well, sometimes you don't have a competitor. And I think anyone who's going down this path and saying they're wanting to implement the whole sustainable procurement piece, they need to decide what do they do if they find issues?
Yeah.
Because do they work with the suppliers to address them? Or do they decide they're going to exit them? Like, you might have some stuff that are absolute deal breakers. If you find certain things, it's absolute deal breaker. But other things, you know, it's not beneficial to the people. If it's a slavery arrangement or whatever it is, it's not helping the people who are in that supply chain in an area that's of concern if you just exit. And also there may have been some sort of a whistleblower thing that's alerted you to it. If you go and just have a knee-jerk reaction, that could have some quite dire consequences further down the supply chain. So that's one of the things you've got to think of. If you're finding things that on a slavery or sustainability side of things you've got concerns about, you need to have decided what items you are going to act on immediately and what items you would work with the supplier on.
And it's about transitioning the hypothetical to the real, saying, well, actually, this looks really good as an ISO, this looks really good as a set of principles and a set of values, but then when you get down to the nitty-gritty, if there isn't a competitor, what do you do?
But even if there is a competitor, you can't necessarily switch tomorrow. If you're in manufacturing and you've got lead times, you've got a competitor needs to tool up equipment, things like that, you know, you can't have absolutely everything sitting there waiting from a contingency. But it comes back into your business continuity planning.
Yeah.
Because likewise, your supplier could have some sort of major disaster. And if you've got a heavy reliance on them or long lead times, you need to know what your contingency is, whether you're holding excess stock, whether you've got alternate suppliers that you can switch to. So this sort of stuff should factor into that sort of planning as well.
Absolutely.
So it's about doing what's right whenever it's possible across those multiple. Do you mind for the listeners listing, you know, the main blocks of what is sustainable procurement? We talked about modern slavery, labour, you know.
Yeah, look, there are core subjects around it. There's the actual governance. So how are you actually implementing this sort of thing? What sort of processes you have?
Yeah.
What sort of how can you access your executive to help drive these sort of things? How can you audit, et cetera? Because there's no point putting this in place if you're not going to actually govern it. You then got the actual human rights side of things. So human rights is where you link in modern slavery. It's about, you know, what it's about the slave side of things, but it's also about, you know, fair work as well. You know, what is considered fair work, exploitation, et cetera. That covers into the, there's another topic then on labour practices. So human rights and labour practices do have quite an overlap. There's also the environment, which a lot of people do understand the environmental side of things. But that's around environmental practices. It's not just about recycling. It's about a lot of things around how you're making sure you are doing things that aren't going to cause impact in the future. A lot of people think the environment and sustainable procurement in general is just about recycled photocopy paper. And nearly every conference I go to, it's almost buzzword bingo for me. Someone's going to mention recycled photocopy paper, and I always want to stand up and go, bingo, because it always comes up. There's fair operating practices. So this is about how you're making sure that you have fair opportunity for everybody. You know, you're not just going, it's not the David and Goliath sort of approach every time you tender. You are letting smaller suppliers have a chance, whether they be Indigenous suppliers, local businesses, things like that, how you're making sure that they're getting a fair opportunity. There's also consumer issues, making sure you are creating stuff that is fit for purpose and how you are honouring that if there's issues, there's quality issues with what you're producing. Community involvement and development. So that's talking about, you know, how are you actually giving back to the community? So you are, especially if you're in a regional location, you are engaging members of your community. How are you? You assisting with them in the longer term as well to make sure that they have a vibrant economic opportunity.
So it's really about caring for the environment around you, the people that work within, you know, the environment around you.
Yeah, it seems a very, very holistic. It's a very holistic view. And there's a couple of things I'd like to come back to, which I'm intrigued by. One is around the governance aspect and access to the executive. And how many, I mean, have you got any examples where everything's in place, but then the executive don't buy into that? Or how? Have you been fortunate enough to have very supportive executives?
I won't name specific organisations. No. I'm certainly aware of organisations where their executive, the Modern Slavery Act is an example, it's being driven by their board and their executive down because they absolutely believe in it. Then other organisations where they're struggling to get anyone to understand what it's about and it does apply to them because they sort of think, oh, we're not exposed to this because people don't understand what it means. Likewise, in other things around the sustainable side, a lot of organisations are thinking that triple bottom line, and they have been for quite a long time. So this is just part of what they do. You don't need to sell it because the sustainability and the environmental piece is just part
inherent
now of what they do.
Yeah.
So a lot of it does depend on the maturity of the organisation, but a lot of it also does depend on individuals at that more executive level wanting to champion things.
It depends on the maturity of the individuals as well as the organisation. I think it's a fascinating thing when... one of my examples in previous role was when working with an organisation where there was absolutely no financial incentive for the executive board to address any of these because there was no, you know, and it was a sort of an organisation where that's all that really mattered. And ultimately the business failed because, you know, the supply chain, competitors, customers started to take a far more... broader and mature view. The other question coming back to is you mentioned about sort of the David and Goliath piece in terms of allowing different entities to at least, you know, be involved in the tender process. Is there a sense of positive discrimination around the small business getting advantageous, not necessarily advantageous terms, but advantageous positioning in a tender process?
Yeah, it's something that does come up a lot. People, you know, the reverse discrimination. And it's a hard one because you can understand where people are coming from. They're saying, well, the big companies are now not getting opportunity because there's special rules of how you bring in some of these other specific areas, especially if you work in government. But on the flip side, I say to people, well, what's the right thing to do here?
Yeah.
You know, if we are trying to encourage this sort of stuff, if we are trying to encourage long-term unemployed people to get roles or people with disabilities to get roles or new migrants to Australia to get skilled up and get roles, we've got massive skill shortages in a lot of areas.
Yeah.
And you've got an untapped workforce that doesn't have the skill set or isn't being given the opportunity. Like, you know, women are 50% of the population, but when you look at some of the statistics, and we've got to start thinking a bit differently on how we access skilled workforce and how we train them up. It's quite interesting if you look at anything in the construction space. So in New South Wales, there's the Infrastructure Skills Legacy Program. And if you look into that, some of the stuff they're forecasting with regards to the gaps they're going to have of the number of workers, it's in the hundreds of thousands. And they're realising they have to start something now to get a lot of the school leavers and the untapped potential. So I take your point going back to earlier about the reverse discrimination, but we are creating an issue for ourselves if we don't start targeting some of these areas. And I mean, there's ways you can do it still that you're giving everybody a fair opportunity. It doesn't mean that you're not giving value for money. you've still got to say, we've got to have value for money in the end of this, but we want ways that we can try and give opportunity to areas that maybe before wouldn't have got a foot in the door.
Yeah, no, and I think I have to qualify from a personal position. I think it's absolutely the right thing to do. But it's one of those questions that more unscrupulous boards might be going, well, why do we do? But having said that, one of the bigger challenges, certainly not only here in Australia, but in the UK where I come from, is at the end of the work career, of the career path as well. So the amount of untapped talent, 50 plus, is still not being adequately harmonised with the rest of the workforce. And I think there's a big challenge there that everybody's missing out on, not only the individuals themselves, but also the organisations and the broader community.
I think many years ago, it was Peugeot, they teamed new workforce with experienced workforce to make sure that we had the new approaches, new thinking, with the experience of someone that has been in the role forever, you know, for a very, very long time. And to them at the time was, you know, the best way to get the best of both worlds, someone very experienced and someone fairly young. So you create a great dynamic. So
yeah, and look, there was examples when I was at Roads and Maritime Services in that space, because there's some very specialised engineering functions where the young people coming through don't study them anymore. And so a lot of the people with these very specialised skill sets are retiring, and they realise that it wasn't the sort of thing you just study for a year or two. A lot of it is on-the-job experience. Yeah. So they were starting to have programs with some of the professional bodies to start some of these very long-term mentoring programs, might be 5-10 years, to start making sure they weren't going to get those skill set shortages as well. Mm-hmm. So not exactly the same as what you were talking about, but it's that still that recognising that you've got a lot of stuff that is starting to exit.
The knowledge.
The knowledge is exiting, and you've got people coming up as well.
You certainly see that in the print and publishing industry in the UK, where there's a massive skills gap in senior management, because the ex-senior management left and they weren't very good at bringing on the juniors. Mm. But then as the juniors get promoted, they've got to a level and they're either replicating bad behaviours from the past, or they're just floundering, and there's that gap. And then there's the sort of almost like the 65, 70 plus knowledge group who must still be invaluable, just saying, well, it's not just about, you know, CMYK, it's about people, you know, it's not just about which paper grade you're using, it's about the people. And it's a big challenge. But I think in terms of, if you're looking around the broad, it's almost, I think the title sustainable procurement potentially misleads more than, you know, coming into this meeting.
Oh, and look, I found that when I was on the committee, the ISO committee, the Australian one, there were a few of us who were practitioners.
Yeah.
And so we did a lot of educating the people who weren't the practitioners on how a lot of this stuff worked in practice, and giving real examples of what sustainability was. And yeah, you're right, there is a lot of misconception, but also working out practically how it would work.
Yeah.
And trying to make sure we were developing a standard that was flexible enough. And I think the whole thing can be very overwhelming, but that's why I said earlier, if you pick particular topics, and I know I suggested the human rights section because of the whole forced labour element of that with regards to modern slavery, but even if it's other things, you might sort of say, look, we're really wanting to focus on governance because we haven't had great governance, and we'll use this to help us put governance in place. I think if you just, you know, bite off bits that you can manage in a particular project, etc., and you're gradually working towards it, that's a way you can do it as well. It could be very overwhelming if you sat down, if your board sat down and said, right, we want to do sustainable procurement, implement this standard.
How long have you got?
And you also, if you don't have skilled up resourcing or resourcing with capacity, you'd struggle as well.
So what would you recommend to someone in procurement that wants to tackle that sustainable procurement to go to the executive?
Well, you need to initially
that can be beaten, something that is manageable.
You need
manageable.
To initially develop your strategy in this space, and you need to work out what are you going to do in year one, year two, year three. It's the same thing for implementing the Modern Slavery Act. You can't do it all before the first reporting cycle next year. So you need to work out what it is you're wanting to achieve and what are the bite-sized chunks of when you're going to do it and how you're going to implement it, etc. And potentially start off with areas, a little bit like we said earlier on, people starting off with some of the low-hanging fruit, like office supplies, because it's easy, similar sort of things. Do ones that it's not so much that it's easy, but ones that make sense. Yes. Governance is a good one. It makes sense. Modern Slavery Act is not negotiable because it's legislation. Yeah. So it's a good one to also get. You have to do something in that space. But if you link it all back, it can start your path in the bigger sustainable piece.
Yeah, and it's a wins that it helps to win the argument within the organisation, because you can go to your executive or you can go to any member of the staff and say, so, do you think we should be doing something about modern slavery, or should we just let it go?
And look, a lot of organisations will have reconciliation action plans. Right. Or they will have Indigenous procurement targets if they're government agencies, whether it be state or federal. So they're probably doing some great work in that space already. And you can apply the similar sort of logic in other areas from the sustainability perspective as well. So don't limit. I'm not saying that you cannibalise that part of what you're doing. Yeah. Absolutely not. But you can still apply a similar approach to say, well, we actually want to expand this. We're doing it in the Indigenous supply side. Let's expand it and think about it in some other areas as well.
That's interesting. So the procurement function is evolving to add another element to it. If you are the one team that has done procurement, you know, for a number of years, and then you start taking that on, something else has to give because you only have so much hours in a day. How do you find that procurement function evolving and going to the executive and say, sorry, I cannot focus too much on that contract because we're going to go after modern slavery?
You need to look at where you are. You should be doing a maturity assessment on a number of different dimensions around your capabilities, around category management, supply management, value realisation, governance, all those things, and work out where are you sitting? Are you developing? Are you advanced? You know, what's your as-is? What's your to-B and how you're going to get there in each of those areas? It's a transformation piece. So as you're going through that, you'd be saying, well, okay, we want to transform how we're delivering value. We want to transform how we're doing our supplier management and sustainable procurement. Yeah, might fit into that. So I would say that people need to firstly do a maturity assessment, work out where they are, work out where they want to be in the different dimensions, and then work out what the programs are they're going to take on to do that. And this would form part of it. A lot of organisations have been around for a long time, but they're essentially acting as compliance or process functions, you know, the policeman of procurement. Yeah. And yeah, there's so much more value. So you need to be able to position with the business that you, if you have early involvement and you are being their trusted advisors, you can help them in a lot of ways you traditionally haven't. And, you know, can they, even if it's a pilot, can they give you a go in maybe a particular area or a couple of projects, getting you involved early and see how you're going, having more of that business partnering sort of side of things. And then that will hopefully allow you to start doing some of that transitioning. So you're not just being about the process, you're being more about the outcome, focusing on the outcome and trying to have a more agile procurement process in the middle. Because procurement is not black and white. Some people will try and tell you it is.
Very different shade of grey.
It's not black and white. And that's where if you're being that trusted advisor, you can help them through that and you can try and help think of different ways to doing stuff. Because running an open tender is not the only answer. But if you're not involved early and helping them think of the different ways and giving them that assurance that what they're doing is not exposing the organisation to risk, you can get some really great outcomes that aren't necessarily long and elongated and positioning you as being bureaucratic and, you know, as I said, compliance focused. So you need to think of all those sort of things if you're wanting to go through these sort of transformations.
Absolutely. And I think it shines a really bright light on the fact of the transition of procurement from, you know, whether it be from your original thoughts of it being in sitting purely in supply chain function, or whether some people's view that it sits purely in finance. Actually, it goes across the whole range of business. It touches on HR, it touches on legal, it touches on every single aspect, marketing as well, because if your company's got a really, you know, robust, sustainable procurement policy, it will market the business positively to customers, but also to potential employees and potential suppliers.
And that's something that interests me as I'm just starting to do a bit of the groundwork in the Modern Slavery Act, is how many organisations aren't marketing that side. Because there's a lot of organisations that are reporting under the UK Act, and you've got to go, you know, 5-6 levels down in their websites to try and find any reference to their statements.
Yeah.
And I always sort of say to them, why are you not marketing this sort of stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, you can do it subtly. You're not sitting there patting yourself on the back. But
no, but it's just saying, you
it's
know.
It's important.
Yeah, it's very important. And I think it's that thing about saying, And of course, you know, we have this position. Mm. And whereas some people used to be, oh yeah, we've got a risk assessment, you know, we've got a risk plan, we know what we're doing. Actually, that's so, you know, out of date now. We should be actively, you know, you would like to get to, hope we get to a stage where everybody, every organisation at any level, you know, completely understands.
Well, it's a little bit like what WH&S and safety was a number of years ago. That's just built into things. People don't even give it a thought now that safety is your number one priority. Yeah. If you're on the construction side of things, it's usually their number one. I hope it's their number one KPI. Yeah. You know, safety briefings when anyone comes on site, safety checks before any work starts, all this sort of stuff is just ingrained in work now. Mm. But if you look back at, you know, I always look at the old photos in the building, the Harbour Bridge, with adding harnesses on, you go, ooh. It's just things have changed so much. So this should evolve in a similar way, that it just becomes the way an organisation wants to do things. They want to do the right thing.
And you know, I think, you know, some people might perceive that as a lofty ideal. I think it's just a really fantastic target to aim for. It's not something that we should be challenging as an end goal. For somebody joining procurement, you know, right at the beginning, yeah. You know, as you said, you know, you sort of not quite stumbled into it, but you made a conscious decision.
Procurement chose me. I refuse to use the expression I fell into procurement, and I challenge any of my peers who use that expression. I always say this in any open forum. You did not stumble into procurement. You had the right skill sets and procurement found you.
But I think, that's absolutely right. But also, I think the point that you made a conscious decision to say, is this the right career for me? And that was an active shift to say, well, I'm going to find out more about this because I'm intrigued by it. And you can, you know, it comes across in terms of the way you speak about it, in the work that you're doing. You're exceptionally passionate about it. So just if you could sort of wrap up and say, so what is procurement?
I mean, procurement is awesome. That's what it is. But in terms of, like, and I do talk to university students about procurement as a profession. Unfortunately, we don't have any undergrad degrees, so it's at the master's level. And just trying to say to people, you know, getting a foot in the door, you know, even just getting on a project, even if there's no opportunities in your procurement team, asking to be on a project and start getting involved in that side of things. And that's often where people really decide they love it, and then they start pursuing it to say, well, I'm an engineer. I'm not actually sure what sort of career progression I've got, but I really liked this procurement that I did when I was on a project and wanting to pursue that. We still have a lot of people who do procurement and don't actually realise they're doing it, and they still identify as being an engineer or a project manager, and it's like, well, actually, no, you are doing procurement. Yeah. So we do suffer a bit from people not actually understanding they're doing procurement if it's not procurement in their title.
Yeah.
So a lot of what I sort of do to people is saying, well, what are you doing? What are you passionate about? Are you spending 80% of your time managing suppliers and contracts? You're actually doing procurement. Maybe you should look at getting into a more formal procurement role, you know, doing some more formal procurement training, because it is something that sounds like you've got the right skill set for.
Yeah.
You know, if you like detail, but you also like talking to people and like helping people and solving problems, you know, you've got a nice skill set there.
That's right. It's about establishing relationships with stakeholders, relationship with suppliers, managing those relationships. It's like managing, you know, a relationship, a marriage, or, you know, it's about doing the right thing. And when you add sustainable procurement, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. So that can turn into a real, you know, a real passion. Turn that as almost like a life purpose, doing the right thing.
Well, it sounds, yeah, and it becomes a far more validating. And I don't mean that in a bad way at all, but I think it, you know, just the holistic view that procurement brings, when you look at, you know, the progress that's been made in terms of the way we think about procurement from 20 years ago to today, and where procurement can be in 20 years' time. Yeah. It is, as I'm going to my careers officer at school.
My careers officer at school is actually friends with my aunt, and I did actually see her a number of years ago, and she asked me what I was doing, and I got the glazed over look.
Yeah,
I had to explain. And she found it really interesting, and she's like, she hadn't even heard of supply chain as a profession. So we have a lot of work to do from that perspective of getting at that age interested. You do struggle getting people into entry-level roles. You'll usually get them interested because, as I said, they've done an element of procurement in a different role. It's very hard to get them sort of straight out of uni or straight out of school into procurement because they just don't understand what it is. So unfortunately at the moment we still have a little bit of that that thing that we can't, it's hard to position it to the people coming up. But you know, like what happened to me, looking out for people who you think have potential and tapping them on the shoulder. They may not actually have a clue what it is you're talking about. But hey, come and spend lots of money and write really long contracts that other people have to read.
Yeah.
It's awesome. No, no, I say that very flippantly, but it is a profession that there's still, you know, the supply and the demand side of things. You know, there's a lot of opportunities for you out there. And it's probably something you'll get a lot better career growth in than some of the traditional disciplines as well.
And I think just when you list, sorry, Christopher, I think when you listed those, the aspects of what sustainable procurement's like, all the areas it taps into, you just think, well, that's fantastic. It's exciting. You know, it's not quite as dry, and it isn't, you know, it isn't the sales prevention office. It isn't the, you know, the knuckle-dragging negotiator who's, you know, trying to cosh.
But if you think procurement is just about running tenders and doing the negotiations, that is almost now, that's almost a transactional process. There's just so much more you can do and not to spend all your time running tenders.
No, I think
we are all procuring. We are all procurement experts. We all go to the shop and buy something. We all compare shirts and, you know, brand versus another brand. We all go to this grocery store or this butcher versus the other butcher and assess quality and where is the meat coming from. We all do that to some extent. It's just taking it at a professional level for an organization. So that love of procurement is not like this foreign concept of what is procurement. We all do it every single day.
It is one of the things, though, that can be one of our biggest challenges because people do it all the time and because a lot of people's decisions on a personal level are done by price.
Yeah.
They often struggle to understand that when you're doing it in a business context, there's a lot of additional things you have to factor in that add to the price. Anyone who's ever managed travel will know exactly what I mean when people say I can get it cheaper on Webjet.
Of course.
Because they don't understand what's behind the scenes with regards to duty of care, all sorts of stuff that factor into pricing when you're doing things at a corporate level. So absolutely take your point, Christoph, that it should appeal to us all because we all do it, but it also is something that becomes a challenge for us because your stakeholders all quite often, not always, but quite often feel that they know how to do your job.
Yeah, and I think it's certainly the executive body on a number of organisations I work for. It's just, well, I know for a fact that I can get that cheaper. You can. I can guarantee you can get it cheaper. Whether you can get it better is a different matter, and whether you can get it fairer is a very different matter.
And I've been very lucky. Somewhere I worked, the actual chief executive there had a procurement background, and that meant that he understood it and got it. And that just made it so much easier for me to get things through because I didn't have to try and sell it to him.
And I think that's a really valid point, actually, saying, you know, being a procurement expert and a champion of procurement, doesn't stop there. It can lead to CEO roles. It can lead to bigger, you know, well, when I say bigger, potentially, you know, if remuneration or prestige of a position is what drives you, you can get there. But procurement actually should be one of the key strings to any organisation succeeding. And if you can get a procurement professional with passion and spirit who can take the organisation further. So just finally wrapping up to where we said, well, it started in supply chain, it's gone through finance, it's in marketing, it's in legal,
we have a chartered institute. You can get your qualifications. I've got my full qualifications. I'm a chartered fellow. Like, we can do the same sort of things that our accounting cousins do. We can get our full qualifications.
But you can lead organisations and you can lead industries with having started up through the procurement stream of the inexorable rise to success. And I think that's a really valuable thing and learning. Christoph, have you
any key message that you want to say?
Apart from saying once again that procurement is awesome. Sorry, I actually, the guys are probably laughing. I actually physically am wearing a badge that says I love procurement. I wear it all the time. It's my talking point in the lifts. If people want to bail me up and say, I hate procurement, and I'll be like, why? Can I come and meet with you? But no, I do genuinely like procurement, or love procurement. And to me, I think I really like the fact that right from a very junior part of my career, I've had exposure to the whole organisation and understood how it worked. And I found that I've only been at the ABC 5 months, but even within the first few weeks, few people who'd been here very long term said to me, you've learnt more about how the organisation works than I have in X number of years. Mm. And it's because we get exposure. We get exposure at the executive levels, but we also get exposure to so many different parts of an organisation. And I think that's just really exciting. And the way we can help benefit things. I mean, that's something that's really, when I've been working for government and where I am now, it's really helped me, and the university, sorry, I shouldn't leave that out. It's really helped me understand that every dollar can really have some great meaning in terms of what your organisation can spend that money on and benefit the end users of the services. And it's not just about going off and spending taxpayers' money in a good, you know, in a transparent, ethical way. It's actually about where that dollar goes, it's just that extra bit that gets some groundbreaking research over the line, whether it's about giving safer roads out in, you know, the communities to reduce the number of deaths on the road because we're able to do the upgrades to them, whether it be where I am now, some of the content we produce and how we can reach Australia at a national level with a lot of our TV channels and our radio channels. You know, that's something that really gives you pride in what you do. You're not just contributing to the bottom line of an organisation. You're really changing people's lives. And I think I've done a number of roles where that's really made me love procurement even more, because I'm not just there helping a company make money. I'm there helping a company fulfil its purpose.
Which, yeah, and that's come across loud and clear, and I think is exactly where, you know, procurement should strive to be.
Spending the right dollar in the right way, in the ethical way.
Yeah.
Mm, exactly.
Sarah, before we let you go, a little question to ask. Andy, you want to ask?
No, I think you can ask it this time.
Give us, in your past, you don't have to mention the name of the company, when you went, oops, I did something wrong.
The biggest mistake.
The biggest mistake.
It could be as a very junior, you know.
I mean, I think mine, I don't know if it's so much a mistake, but probably in my earlier days when I was first understanding what procurement was, when we were doing some of the categories that were sort of more the quick wins, et cetera, you know, some of the processes I followed there, I was in the private sector. I hadn't been exposed to procurement with really strong probity and governance and that side of things. And I'm not saying that anything we ran exposed the organisation, but, you know, at the time it was, you just invited suppliers to tender. You weren't necessarily doing open tenders. You know, you thought nothing once you had contracted suppliers that you had, you went to invitations for Christmas parties and things like that. I'm talking like 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So things have changed. I would never do that sort of stuff again. I wouldn't say it's a mistake, but it has opened my eyes up to a lot of the practices and how you need to really have that transparency and that probity. And, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Yeah.
And I, even if I went back to pure private sector now, I would very much still have the discipline of what I've had in the public sector.
Yeah.
And I would instill that on my teams as well.
Yeah.
They may not like that, but I would instill it on my teams because I really believe in that side of things. And that was something I, earlier in my career, I had no exposure to.
Yeah.
I probably didn't even know what the word probity meant.
Yeah.
And I don't think it caused any issues, but when I look back at it now and you look at those practices, you think you are actually exposing your organisation from a probity and governance perspective without even really knowing it, because you don't have that understanding of the implications.
Yeah, I think that's a really, you know, we will be doing a procurement podcast solely looking at probity, or in fact the dark art of procurement and where the pitfalls are, because it's something that even now still can be quite prevalent and can do untold damage to organisations, you know, and to individuals as well. So thank you so much for your time. Really do, I think it's been a hugely useful and valid conversation, and would like if you could just recount the website for the ISO.
Yes, so it's iso2400.org, and that's where you can find links if you did want to buy the standard, but also the case studies and the resources, etc., that have been developed around it are in there as well. And so I just remind you again, the thing we developed in Australia is the How to Build the Actual Business Case. It's available for free. And that sits there on the website as well. And we'd encourage people, if you can, to use it as a starting point. I mean, hey, if you don't want to use it, that's fine, but it hopefully is a framework you can use as a starting point on how to actually start addressing the different areas. And there's a lot of really useful resources in there too. So if you're saying, I really want to focus on the fair operating practices side of it, there's a whole stack of links in there to how you can understand arrangements that are in place around whether it be ethical side of procurement, whether it be some of the watchdog bodies we have in some of the states, the Ombudsman, the ICACs, things like that, what they do, their functions, case studies of when it goes wrong. So there's a lot of information in there that can help you, as well as build the business case, can help you also explain through tangible examples mm-hmm. to your executive of what we mean by this or what can happen if it goes wrong.
Brilliant. Well, I do hope everybody who listens to the podcast enjoys it as much as I certainly have, and I'm sure.
Yeah. Should you have any question for Sarah Collins, please email info@procurementpodcast.com, and we'll make sure to relay that information to Sarah. Should you wish to have Sarah speak at your organization, give us an email and we'll pass that information to Sarah as well.
And thank you. I always love talking to people and just creating networks. And we're doing that with the Modern Slavery Act. Just anyone I can, I'm creating networks with. And because we've got a lot of organisations where we normally would not overlap remotely, and there's so much information and learnings we can share in some of these spaces. And I think that's one thing procurement does really well that maybe other industries or other professions don't. We do talk to our peers in different organisations, and that's one of the things I love as well.
Well, I think we've established you love procurement.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. That's
Sarah,
wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Procurement Podcast with Andy and Christoph. For more information, please visit our website, procurementpodcast.com, and feel free to email us your questions at info@procurementpodcast.com.